From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The Bush administration ordered the systematic bombing of Iraq, and the goal was clear: destroy the country's ability to resist. That was in 2002, 6 months before Bush went to the United Nations and 5 months before he went to the U.S. Congress.
The smoking bullet in the smoking gun. Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill reports on new documents that show Bush began the invasion of Iraq more than half a year before the official start of the invasion. We'll also speak with Hans von Sponeck, the former U.N. Assistant Secretary General. He says when he began documenting U.S. and British airstrikes on Iraq, he was pressured by those governments to keep quiet.
A senior British official commenting on the airstrike reporting we were doing out of Baghdad said all the United Nations is doing, putting an imprint of legitimacy on Iraqi propaganda.
Then we'll speak with Minnesota State Senator Becky Lurie. She authored an anti-war resolution opposing the invasion of Iraq. Her son Matt was killed there 2 weeks ago.
It's not just all of the service people who are dying now. It is why they are dying and what's going to be happening. Who are going to be our leaders?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, the Pentagon has revealed last month was the deadliest month so far of the Iraq War for part-time U.S. servicemen and women. A total of 31 died, including 14 members of the Army National Guard and 12 from the Marine Corps Reserve. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has rejected a request from the governor of Montana to temporarily send home members of the Montana National Guard. The state's governor, Brian Schweitzer, requested the reserves to come home because they're needed to fight summer wildfires in the forests of the Rocky Mountains. The Montana Guard is facing what's described as an unprecedented shortage of firefighters and helicopters because of the Iraq war. In Baghdad, the Iraqi government has announced Saddam Hussein will face 12 charges of crimes against humanity when he goes to trial, which is expected to begin in the next 2 months. The main charges against him include the 1988 chemical attack on the Kurdish village of Halabja, the repression of the 1991 Shiite rebellion, and the 1990 invasion of Kuwait. If convicted, Saddam Hussein faces the death penalty. In other news from Iraq, the U.S. military is reporting it has detained nearly 900 suspected members of the Iraqi resistance in Baghdad over the past 2 weeks as part of a campaign called Operation Lightning. And U.S. forces reported uncovering and destroying two vast underground bunkers being used by Iraqi fighters. A top Democratic senator and the New York Times have both called for the Bush administration to shut down the Guantanamo Bay military prison. Senator Joseph Biden, who's the top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, made the call Sunday on ABC's This Week. The New York Times condemned Guantanamo in an editorial Sunday, saying, quote, "It's a propaganda gift to America's enemies, an embarrassment to our allies, a damaging repudiation of the American justice system, and a highly effective recruiting tool for Islamic radicals, including future terrorists," the Times wrote. On Friday night, after the evening news shows had already aired, the Pentagon released new details on how the Quran had been mishandled at Guantanamo. The Pentagon confirmed in one instance a soldier deliberately kicked the Muslim holy book. In another case, an interrogator stepped on the book. In addition, the Pentagon confirmed at least three other cases where the holy book was damaged at the prison. In one case, the Pentagon claimed a Quran was splashed with urine after a soldier urinated through an air vent. On Saturday, tens of thousands of people gathered in Hong Kong to mark the 16th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. On June 4, 1989, Chinese troops violently crushed student pro-democracy protests. Human rights groups say hundreds, if not thousands, of unarmed protesters were killed. Hundreds more arrested, and as many as 250 remain in prison. Outside of Hong Kong, there was no public commemorations of the anniversary in China. Dissidents and relatives of the Tiananmen victims were reportedly put under government surveillance and warned not to take part in memorials. Protesters in Hong Kong also called on the Chinese government to release journalist Qing Chang, the chief China correspondent for the Straits Times newspaper. China's claim the journalist has admitted to being a spy. The Associated Press is reporting John Bolton helped force out a top official at the United Nations ahead of the Iraq invasion because he feared the official could interfere with the Bush administration's war plans. The Senate's now considering Bolton to be Washington's ambassador to the United Nations. According to the Associated Press, Bolton flew to Europe in 2002 to personally demand Jose Bustani resign his post as head of a global arms control agency called the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. At the time, Bustani was trying to send chemical weapons inspectors to Baghdad. If the inspectors had been sent in 2002, they would have uncovered Iraq had no chemical weapons, a discovery that would undermine the Bush administration's rationale for war. One of Bustani's former aides, Bob Rigg, said the motivation of Bolton and the Bush administration was clear in removing Bustani. Rigg said, quote, they felt they couldn't rely on the UN agency to come up with the findings the U.S. wanted. After Bustani refused to resign, the Bush administration successfully removed him during a controversial vote that was later deemed to be unlawful. Ahead of the vote, the U.S. delegation threatened to withhold U.S. dues from the agency if Bustani stayed in office. On Capitol Hill, Senator Patrick Leahy is calling on the Bush administration to investigate whether any U.S.-trained troops in Uzbekistan took part in last month's bloody massacre that left hundreds dead. The Financial Times reported one U.S.-based human rights investigator said there was, quote, very credible evidence that at least one Uzbek commander who took part in the killings was trained by the United States. In Tampa, Florida, the trial of former Palestinian professor Sami Alarian begins today. The government's accused Alarian and eight others of racketeering, conspiracy, and providing material support to terrorists. The government alleges Alarian used an Islamic academic think tank and a Palestinian charity to illegally funnel money to the militant group Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Until his arrest, Alarian was one of the most prominent Palestinian academics and activists in the United States. He was invited to the White House during both the President Clinton and Bush administrations and campaigned for President Bush during the 2000 election. Alarian has already faced one court setback. Late last month, the court rejected his request to move the trial outside Tampa. Alarian's defense team has argued that the local media's biased coverage has prejudiced potential jurors. Alarian's lawyer, William Moffitt, said, quote, I'm extremely disappointed. This is probably the first time I will go into a case believing my client is not presumed innocent. In Haiti, as many as 25 people died following police raids in the capital of Port-au-Prince. On Friday and Saturday, police raided poor sections of the city that are largely populated by supporters of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Local residents accused the police of setting at least 12 homes on fire. Over the past year, human rights groups have repeatedly accused the Haitian police of carrying out summary executions and abuses against supporters of Aristide. In news from the Middle East, the Jerusalem City Council has ordered the homes of about 1,000 Palestinians to be demolished. The Guardian of London reports this would amount to the city's largest mass demolitions in recent history. The Jerusalem City Council said the homes were built illegally and need to be removed in order to restore the area as a national park. But Israeli human rights activists say the government is trying to forcibly remove Palestinians from an area that's needed to expand Jewish settlements in East Jerusalem. A new study has ranked San Francisco and Portland, Oregon, as the most environmentally sustainable cities in the country. The organization SustainLane ranked these cities on 12 categories, ranging from transportation to energy use. Other cities ranked in the top 10 were Berkeley, Seattle, Santa Monica, Austin, New York, Chicago, Oakland, Minneapolis, and Denver. At the bottom of the list, Houston, Detroit, and Albuquerque. Criticism over police use of taser stun guns is mounting across the country. In Akron, Ohio, protests were held last week following the death of 18-year-old Richard Holcomb, who was shot while police were trying to subdue him. In San Jose, California, a group called the Barrio Defense Committee has called for protests following the death of Samuel Martinez. Police said they shot the 34-year-old man with a taser after he tried to hit an officer. And in Sacramento, police are investigating the death of a man Saturday after he was hit with a taser. At least 110 people have now died in the United States and Canada following police taser strikes since 1999. Meanwhile, in Florida, a 22-year-old woman is threatening to sue the Boynton Beach Police Department after they tasered her last year during a routine traffic stop. Victoria Goodwin was originally pulled over for speeding just after she dropped her daughter off at daycare. Police then discovered she had a suspended driver's license, a broken windshield, and a broken taillight. Police shot her after she refused to get out of her SUV. Video of the shooting was released last week by the police department.
Go and put your cigarette out, step out of the vehicle for me. Put your phone down.
No, I'm calling somebody.
I'm going to tell you one more time. Put your phone down.
Mark, the police pulled me over, and he's telling me that he's going to arrest me. And he's arresting me. Stop. Don't touch me. The policeman is, you're going to shoot me? He's got a gun, and he's
going to
shoot me.
Get out of the car now, or I'm going to tase you. Get out of the car now, or I'm going to tase you. I'm going to tell you one more time. I'm going to tell you one more time. Get out of the car. Get out of the car or I'm going to tase you.
The next street off the Seacrest.
Put your hands behind your back. Do it now. Do it now or you're going to get tased again. Do it now.
That was a video of police in Florida shooting the 22-year-old woman with a taser gun after she refused to get out of her SUV during a traffic stop. Police defended the shooting as proper procedure. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It was marked secret and strictly personal, UK eyes only. That was the header of the Downing Street memo that exposed a meeting in July 2002 between British Prime Minister Tony Blair and a senior national security team. The text to the minutes of the secret briefing was published by the Sunday Times of London last month. In the briefing, Richard Dearlove, then director of the British intelligence agency, MI6, told Blair that the U.S. had already made plans to attack Iraq. According to the leaked minutes, Dearlove said the U.S. attack would be, quote, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD. He went on to say, quote, the intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy. Though the revelation of the so-called Downing Street memo initially saw very little attention from the mainstream U.S. media, calls for a full investigation have gained momentum. 89 House members have called on President Bush to answer questions surrounding the memo. Congressman John Conyers is in the process of collecting 100,000 signatures demanding the president address the accuracy of the document. And last week, former presidential candidate Senator John Kerry told the Massachusetts Standard Times newspaper he'll be raising the issue of the memo when he returns to Washington this week. He went on to say, quote, I think it's a stunning, unbelievably simple and understandable statement of the truth and a profoundly important document that raises stunning issues here at home. And it's amazing to me the way it escaped major media discussion. It's not being missed on the internet, I can tell you that, John Kerry said. Since the Downing Street memo revelations, more evidence has come out showing the U.S. and the Royal Air Force increased their airstrikes on Iraq in the months preceding the invasion in order to provoke Saddam Hussein into giving the Allies an excuse for war. Here to talk about this all with us is Jeremy Scahill, producer and correspondent for Democracy Now!, has an article at the Nation magazine's website called The Other Bomb Drops, How Bush Began the Iraq Invasion Before He Went to Congress or the UN. We're also joined on the telephone by Hans von Sponeck, former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. And we're joined by John Boniface, who has just begun a website that deals with this issue. He is author of Warrior King, The Case for Impeaching George W. Bush. The website is called After DowningStreet.org, a coalition of various groups urging Congress to begin a formal investigation into whether Bush has committed impeachable offenses in connection with the invasion of Iraq. Let's begin, Jeremy, with you. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's
on this side of the mic. Talk about what you found.
Well, I think for many people who have been following the politics of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, it comes as no surprise to learn that the Bush administration intentionally misled the U.S. public and the world and operated with tremendous bad faith when it said it was trying to do everything it could to avoid war. And what we have here is really solid documentation that backs that up. What the British Times of London published last weekend was statistics from the British Defense Ministry that showed that in the second half of 2002, let's remember that the invasion of Iraq officially began in March of 2003, that from May 2002 until the end of 2002, that the United States and Britain doubled the number of attacks that they were carrying out against Iraq from the whole of 2001. So what you saw was the Bush administration ordering attacks, offensive attacks on Iraq that were intended to take out communication infrastructure in the country, the ability of commanders in the Iraqi military to communicate with one another, pretty much defensive mechanics for the country. And these attacks were happening with the justification that they were protecting the so-called no-fly zones in Iraq. The real scandal here is that the Bush administration, like the Clinton administration before it, oversaw the longest sustained bombing campaign since Vietnam. We reported on this show for years consistently that the United States was bombing Iraq once every 3 days. This bombing began, you could say that the preparations for this invasion began the moment that the so-called Gulf War ended, and that Clinton laid the groundwork for this in his regular bombings of Iraq. We saw a spike in activity in these so-called no-fly zone attacks, which had no UN mandate whatsoever, which were not approved by the international community.
Are often mistakenly called the UN no-fly zones.
Right, and it was only the United States and Britain. France pulled out almost immediately after the United States began this program. So you had it, the United States and Britain, and then with the approval and support of some of the puppet regimes in the region that were, for whatever reason, in bed with the United States. After the passage of the Iraq Liberation Act in 1998, you saw an escalation in these so-called no-fly zones. The Clinton administration was using them to try to provoke Saddam Hussein's regime into attacking the United States to justify further attacks. And you remember there was the heavy bombing known as Operation Desert Fox in December of 1998. So the Clinton administration is not innocent here. It carried out illegal bombings against Iraq consistently throughout the presidency of Clinton. What we saw that sort of changed here under Bush is that the Bush administration dropped all of the rhetoric about the no-fly zones having something to do with defending Shiites or Kurds, and actually were quite public about what they were using these no-fly zones for. They were using them to systematically and preemptively degrade Iraq's ability to defend itself, not from an uprising of Shiites or Kurds, but from the invasion of a foreign army.
And then can you locate the Downing Street memo? Talk about its significance and what happened with the bombing then. This Downing Street memo, what, July 23rd, 2002?
It reports on a meeting that senior British officials had with members of the Bush administration. And what it is a reflection of what the British understood to be the United States policy at the moment. And what's clear from reading this, it's actually not a memo, it's minutes, but it's called the Downing Street memo. It's minutes of this meeting with Tony Blair and some of his most senior defense advisors. And the picture that is painted from this memo is that the United States already was not just planning and preparing for war, but was actively carrying out airstrikes in support of this war. The invasion had begun already when the British had this meeting. And we find that in the form of remarks attributed to Jeff Hoon within these minutes, where he is talking about the Americans already spiking up activity against Saddam Hussein. And what he's referring to is the increasing use of these so-called no-fly zones to degrade Iraq's ability to defend against a U.S. invasion and to prepare the route for U.S. special forces to enter into the country. In September of of 2002. Now, this is months before the actual invasion officially began, and a few months before Bush went to the Congress or the United Nations. 100 aircraft violate Iraqi airspace, British and American aircraft. They go in and they carry out a systematic campaign of airstrikes in the west of Iraq and basically destroy the west of Iraq's ability to defend against an invasion. And that was one of the main places where U.S. Special Forces troops came in from Jordan into the west of Iraq. That happened in September of 2002. We're talking about months before the actual invasion began.
We're talking to Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, has a piece in The Nation Online called The Other Bomb Drops. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Attorney John Boniface and the former U.N. Assistant Secretary General Hans von Sponeck. Stay with us. Dream by Rahim Alhaj here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests are Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent, John Boniface, author of Warrior King, The Case for Impeaching George W. Bush, as well as Hans von Sponeck, Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, formerly. Looking at this Times of London piece that came out last month, John Boniface, I'd like you to respond to this secret document from the heart of government, revealing that Tony Blair privately committed Britain to war with Iraq and then set out to lure Saddam Hussein into providing the legal justification. This, according to the Times of London, they write, the Downing Street minutes, headed secret and strictly personal, UK eyes only, detail one of the most important meetings ahead of the invasion. It was chaired by the Prime Minister, attended by his inner circle. The document reveals Blair-backed regime change by force from the outset, despite warnings from Lord Goldsmith, the Attorney General, that such action could be illegal. The minutes that were published by the Sunday Times begin with the warning, "This record is extremely sensitive. No further copies should be made. The paper should be shown only to those with a genuine need to know." It records this meeting in July 2002, attended by military and intelligence chiefs, of which Blair discussed military options, having already committed himself to supporting President George Bush's plans for ousting Saddam. Can you talk about the significance of this for President George Bush?
Sure, Amy. I mean, the reality here is that this evidence from this Downing Street memo reveals that the president may have engaged in a conspiracy to mislead and deceive the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for going to war against Iraq, and may have, in effect, undermined and violated the War Powers Clause of the United States Constitution, which makes it quite clear that Congress and only Congress has the power to declare war. It was not in his power to start a war long before even going to Congress in October 2002, even if that resolution in October 2002 was not a proper declaration of war. So what we have started with AfterDowningStreet.org is a campaign on behalf of a coalition of veterans groups, peace groups, and organizations around this country calling upon Congressman John Conyers Jr. and other members of Congress to launch a resolution of inquiry formally investigating whether the president has committed impeachable offenses in connection with this war. Is it a high crime to lie to the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for going to war? That question must now be answered.
Can you talk about AfterDowningStreet.org and this whole movement that is now developing?
Well, we've launched this less than 2 weeks ago. We've already received over 100,000 hits to the website. Thousands of people are weighing in support of this campaign, and we believe that Congressman Conyers and others need to stand up as they have in the past and urge that this administration be held accountable for its potential impeachable offenses. And the president himself must be held accountable. James Madison said when talking about the impeachment clause of the Constitution that a president is impeachable if he subverts the Constitution. And it is a clear subversion of the Constitution to lie to the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for sending the nation to war, sending young men and women off to their death based on a potential lie. This president needs to be held accountable for that illegal action.
John Boniface, I want to ask you about what appears later in the Sunday Times of London piece. It says, the July meeting was later mentioned by Lord Butler in his report on the use of intelligence on WMD as a key stage in the road to war, but its details have never been revealed until now. The minutes show that Goldsmith warned Blair 8 months before war started, that was March 19, 2003, that finding legal justification would be difficult. The Attorney General only ruled unambiguously war was lawful a few days before the war started, after Admiral Sir Michael Boyce, chief of the defense staff, demanded unequivocal written confirmation. Boyce was never shown Goldsmith's more equivocal advice to Blair, and says today ministers failed to give him protection from prosecution at the International Criminal Court. He said, I've always been troubled by the ICC, adding that if British servicemen are put on trial, ministers should be brought into the frame as well. Asked if that should include Blair and Goldsmith, the Attorney General, he told the Observer newspaper, too bloody right. Can you talk about liability here?
Well,
what he means.
Clearly there's liability for British officials, including Tony Blair, under the International Criminal Court, since Britain is a signatory to the treaty that created that court. The United States decided not to sign that treaty, in part because it did not want to have its officials held liable for any of these kinds of potential war crimes and other crimes under international law. However, it's important to note that the United States forces used U.K. bases out of Diego Garcia and Cyprus, which if in fact there were war crimes or violations of international law that have occurred, the United States could also be implicated by having used those British air bases. So I think that we have to look at all the questions here, both in terms of violations of international law as well as our United States Constitution. And we as a people have a recourse under the U.S. Constitution, and that's the impeachment clause to remove any president for violations of the Constitution, for violations of federal law. And this president needs to be held accountable if he committed high crimes.
Jeremy Scahill.
I mean, to look at the politics of this, it's very interesting that John Kerry, Senator John Kerry, raised this issue last week and said that he's going to be raising the Downing Street minutes publicly. And there's been a firestorm of controversy. In fact, the far right-wing publications, Newsmax, all of these, Ann Coulter, clique of people, have made a big deal about this. John Kerry is going to bring articles of impeachment against President Bush. But I think we need to step back and look at something here. If an honest assessment was done, what we're looking at is George Bush picking up from where Clinton left off and just taking it a step further. Bill Clinton systematically attacked Iraq throughout his entire presidency. He oversaw the largest sustained bombing campaign since Vietnam. What a congressional committee with subpoena power should really do is go back and subpoena every military official who's ever had anything to do with these so-called no-fly zones. Bring them in front of Congress, swear them in, and ask them, what were your orders both given and received? And what you'll see is a systematic violation of international law and the U.S. Constitution that was supported openly by Democrats. And so John Conyers, who's consistently been against these things, is the perfect person to raise these kinds of charges because his voting record shows that he's been consistently opposed to it. Many of the Democrats in the Senate and the House have big problems because they supported the Iraq Liberation Act. They supported the pummeling of Iraq, the punishment of Iraqi civilians through these bombings. And I've met people whose children have been killed in these bombing zones. And that's what we have to remember. There was a human price here that was very heavy. And we've reported on that on Democracy Now! This is a case of the media need to follow these events in real time. This was a bombing that was happening very publicly, and it was documentable in real time. And it's great that now it's getting attention. But one of the problems that the Democrats are going to run into on Capitol Hill is you need to go back and look at their policies, their positions, their votes. And it's going to be damning of them.
I want to bring in Hans von Sponeck here, the former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. You were in office during some of the time that Jeremy is now just talking about. Can you talk about you being on the ground in Iraq and what you understood was happening?
Well, let me first say, in addition to my role as the humanitarian coordinator for the Oil for Food program, I was also the designated official for security of United Nations staff in Iraq. And in that context, of course, we paid attention to what was happening in the no-fly zones. And what was quite noticeable is that after Operation Desert Fox of December 1998, there was a very distinct increase in the number of incidents perpetrated by the U.S. and U.K. air forces involving civilian property, involving civilians. And we ascribed that at the time as a result of instructions given by the two governments in Washington and London to allow pilots to operate under what is known as enlarged rules of engagement, giving pilots more freedom to decide whether to attack an installation or whether to engage in other destabilization attempts in the two no-fly zones, and by the way, at times also straying over into the fly zone. The fly zone was not entirely without incidents during the time since Operation Desert Fox in 1998. And as a result of this development, we in Baghdad decided very quickly that we would begin to record these incidents not as they affected the military, that wasn't our business, but as they affected the security of United Nations staff and, of course, the civilian population in Iraq. That meant that we started to issue airstrike reports, where we every 3 months issued such a report for the consumption of the UN Security Council, for the Office of the Secretary General and other officials at the UN in New York. And we made sure at the time to be discreet about this, not to give it to the press, but to give it to those who had something to do with these incidents. I myself would, when I visited New York, see the U.S. ambassador, see the British ambassador, and hand to them these copies. And I remember on one occasion I told both of them that when I gave them a report with pictures, I said, your pilots see it from up there, 10,000 meters above, and this is how we see it on the ground. Huh. And it was striking to see the reaction, which was extremely angry and negative. I was told by a British official that all we were doing were putting the imprint of legality, of legitimization on Iraqi propaganda, which was not at all the case.
You said you were giving this directly to the British ambassador to the UN and to the U.S. ambassador to the UN?
Indeed. When I went there, I handed copies to Ambassador Burley at the time, he will remember, and I also gave the reports to the British mission, to the Ambassador Eldon, who was the number two ambassador, to Sir Jeremy Greenstock, who was particularly agitated over the fact that I was instrumental in having these documents prepared by my security office in Baghdad.
Ambassador Greenstock was particularly agitated?
Well, no, his deputy, who had been deputy manager, which he would always tell you with great pride, of the 1991 Gulf War arrangements. It led to, in fact, a request to the Secretary General that I be removed because of one of the main reasons, because I was issuing these reports, which the United Nations found quite useful, and I was encouraged to continue to write them.
So they were pressuring for you to be removed for reporting the effects of the bombing on the ground in Iraq.
That's, Amy, that I'm afraid is correct, and it's not the only, but it was one of the reasons why the two governments felt that I was unsuitable for that position in Iraq. And all I was doing as a civil servant was to relay the cold-blooded facts that arose as a result of these incursions, these illegal incursions, after all. Well, I continued with the full support of the UN Secretariat.
I wanted to ask you about another UN official who was forced out. The Associated Press reporting John Bolton helped force out a top official at the UN ahead of the Iraq invasion because he feared the official could interfere with the Bush administration's war plans. According to the Associated Press, Bolton flew to Europe in 2002 to personally demand that Jose Bustani resign his post as head of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. At the time, Bustani was trying to send chemical weapons inspectors to Iraq. If the inspectors had been sent then, they would have uncovered no chemical weapons, a discovery that would undermine the Bush administration's rationale for war. Did you know about this at the time?
Actually, Mr. Bustani is heading or headed an organization that's not part of the UN system. That is, it's totally outside the gamut of the United Nations. But I think what agitated the U.S. and maybe John Bolton was the fact that he tried at the time to bring Iraq into signing the Chemical Weapons Prohibition Act. And I think that that led to the wrath of Washington and maybe to contributed to the decision to remove this senior official of an important institution.
Hans von Sponeck, from your position as former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, your response to the Downing Street memo and the documents that have come out since, the significance of the meeting, both for Blair and for President Bush?
I would say, Amy, that this document is simply formal evidence of what was not a secret since, in fact, since mid-2002. In October 2004, during a meeting with Robin Cook, former Foreign Secretary of the UK in Brighton, I was told by him that in mid-2002, meaning at the time when this memo, these minutes were written, they knew already in London that Prime Minister Blair had agreed with Mr. Bush to join him in going to war against Iraq. And what we see in the ensuing period, in retrospect, now this is now one can say it. Then it was more difficult to discover, but one can say that there was a gradual, planned build up, and it was not a question of a policy decision any longer. It was a PR exercise. How do we sell this to the public? How do we get through this to the objective which we have decided to have, which is to implement the Clinton October 1998 Iraq Liberation Act, which the U.S. Congress passed, which calls for regime change. But at that time, it was more a regime change from within using Iraqi opposition. But this, of course, all changed on January 2001 when the Bush administration came in and translated into a very clear decision, and that is to go to war against that country. And apparently, in mid-2002, the British came on board, and this memo, that these minutes that are now available to the public, simply formalized what was already decided.
It's the last 30 seconds, Jeremy Scahill.
I think clearly what's needed right now is a congressional investigation, and this is extremely important. This should be a mainstream issue in this country, that President Bush began the invasion of Iraq, the air war against Iraq, a year before he actually officially began it, months before he went to the Congress, months before he went to the United Nations. And the problem right now is that the Republicans are not going to allow the Democrats to hold a hearing with subpoena power, and that's the primary issue. But the last point I want to make is that this is yet another case of seeing that actually Baghdad Bob, Chemical Ali, these guys were telling the truth. And they were saying the Bush administration is trying to provoke another Gulf of Tonkin here by coming in and escalating these bombings. That's what Amir Saadi, senior advisor to Saddam Hussein, said to me the last time I talked to him. Tariq Aziz, the last time I talked to him, said the same thing. They're sending U-2 spy planes. They want us to shoot it down. They're looking for a reason to go to war. That's clear right now. And there are so many pieces of evidence that one can turn to prove this. This is one of the most rock solid, and it should be exploited by the Congress right now to prove that Bush lied to the American people.
Jeremy Scahill, correspondent for Democracy Now!, was in Iraq almost a year leading up to the invasion of Iraq. John Boniface, co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org, and Hans von Sponeck, Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, formerly. Thanks all for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Stay with us.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction.
And Sarah Thompson is it for freedom. You can see her music at cdbaby.com/Sarah T. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last month in Iraq, 77 U.S. soldiers died, making it the deadliest month for the U.S. military since January. That brought the official number of Americans killed since March 2003 to more than 1,660 people. Among those killed in the last 2 weeks were two soldiers who died when their helicopter was shot down near the resistance stronghold of Bakuba. The pilot of that helicopter was on his second tour of duty in Iraq. He was Matt Lurie from Minnesota, happened to be the son of Minnesota State Senator Becky Lurie, who was a leading opponent in her state of the invasion of Iraq. She authored an anti-war resolution signed by 18 other state senators before she introduced the resolution. She consulted her son, Matt. He told her, "You absolutely have my permission, Mom. Freedom of speech is imperative." I spoke with State Senator Becky Lurie by telephone and asked her to talk about her son.
He was a dedicated person. He believed that his duty was going to be to serve his country by serving in the armed services, and he always wanted to fly. And it wasn't an easy path for him. There were many obstacles, but he persevered in a variety of unusual steps. And my husband was a staunch anti-war protester in the Vietnam era, and as was I, and my husband kept trying to dissuade Matt from his calling, and I recognized it as his calling, and so I made sure that he got to all of the Thunderbird flights that he wanted to go to, because he built a wooden airplane when he was early in junior high school, and he hung it in a big box elder tree, and he said, "I built this to give my younger brothers and sisters rides, Mom," and he did, in like a big swing. And then one day I looked out, and he was sitting in the plane that he built himself, and he had on his World War I ace flying hat with the goggles and a white scarf around his neck flying, and he had rigged it up with ropes from other branches of the tree so that he, in fact, could fly it himself in the tree. And so this was his calling. And even though he believed this to have not been the right way to go to war. He was trained and equipped to provide aerial reconnaissance in support of ground troops. And he said once, whether the troops are in a righteous war or if it's an ill-conceived, poorly planned war, rather than a defensive war for which he was trained, he just felt he was the most experienced senior person, and it was his responsibility. And his troops deserved what he could provide. And so he went back a second time. You know, he had he actually had another job offer. He flew the fixed-wing transport as well, and he had a job offer in D.C. And when his people went back, he said he had to be there with them.
State Senator Becky Laurie, when you introduced the resolution against the invasion, first of all, what did it say? And can you talk about where your son was then in March of 2003?
Oh, you know, where was he in March of 2003? You know, he'd been in Bosnia before that, and then he was stationed in Egypt. And, you know, a lot of the communication that you do is over the email. And so I can't remember where he was when I sent him a copy of the resolution.
Well, can you tell us what the resolution said and how he responded?
What he said to me was, Mom, freedom of speech is absolutely important. It's what we do, and it's what we protect. It's what a democracy is based on, and you absolutely have every right to present this petition against the war in Iraq. He was very, very supportive, and I made sure to put a paragraph in there that I'll read that paragraph. We give our unconditional support to U.S. military personnel serving at home and abroad in their tireless battle against global terrorism. And should our military forces engage in war in Iraq, we give our unyielding support to our young men and women serving in our nation's military, even if we oppose the policy that sent them there.
We're talking to Minnesota State Senator Becky Laurie on the phone with us from her office as she continues her work after the loss of her son last week, shot down in his helicopter in Iraq. Did you take your son on anti-war demonstrations when he was growing
yes,
up?
Yes, we did. We took him. You know, growing up, the children were born in the early 60s, and so there were wonderful, wonderful people to inspire them. You know, Martin Luther King. We went on many civil rights events, and we worked for feminist rights, and we worked for peace. And so, you know, his college degree was in sociology. So, so he had a real sense of justice, and he decided to serve. He always wanted to serve, you know, because every country requires a military, and it requires it for defense, not for preemptive war, not for preemption. I mean, I'm so scared. We're living in a time of preemption rather than a time of cooperation, and the people that inspired us during the 60s, their voices are there, but they're so hard to be heard.
State Senator Becky Laurie, in reading the piece about your son, A Death in the Family, in the Pioneer Press this weekend, I was in Minnesota, it talked about how Matt had joined, he wanted to learn to fly, but in fact, he didn't get trained by the military. He ended up flipping pancakes for quite a long time and ended up training himself.
Yes, yes. He'd finished 1 year of college, and then he said, I'm going to join the Marines, and his dad and I said, well, Matt, we'd think that you have to have a college degree to fly, don't you? And he said, no, they said that I could fly, but that, you know, I had to do this other first. So he was a cook in the Marines for 4 years, and has a... Oh, listen, I'm saying he had a scar across the top of his forehead from wild seas, you know, when they went sliding across the galley one time. And then when he finished that four-year stint, he said, okay, now I'm ready to fly. And they said, well, you're a cook. You know, you get to cook. We don't retrain you as a pilot. And so he joined the Army Reserve. And he went to Ely Community College. It's now called Vermilion Community College, up in, you know, the border of between Minnesota and Canada. And he became a bush pilot. And then once he learned to fly, then the Army accepted him as a helicopter pilot. I mean, they had trained him, but now that he had the experience.
So he got it on his own. He learned to flip pancakes in the military, and he learned to fly on his own.
Yes, yes. And but the really wonderful thing for Matt and for his, you know, his siblings as they watched the tension between Matt's father and Matt, after he learned to fly, then you have these. You have to be rigorously healthy, and Matt had high cholesterol, and that was just a devastating blow. That's when he became a vegetarian and a marathon runner, which is how he met his wife. They're both stationed in Egypt, and they were running. They met running a marathon, but he became a vegetarian and a marathon runner, and never ever did his cholesterol get out of control again. And then, when he was doing that, you know, pilots have to have incredible eye capabilities, and there looked like there might be a challenge there. And before that was resolved, his father said to him, "Matt, I see how much this is what you see as your calling, and I hope that the eye situation turns out okay, because now I support your, I support what you feel you need to do." And it was just such a wonderful time, such a wonderful time, because Matt could relax, and I think that if that hadn't happened, it would be even harder now for Matt's father.
You had a chance to question Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld as a state legislator when he addressed the National Conference of State Legislatures.
I had forgotten that. I had forgotten that. I was so upset about everything that I actually thought, I'm chair of the Health Committee here in the Senate, and here we are spending $1 million a day on this war, and we can't take care of the medical challenges facing us with our aging population. I had just come from a meeting where the it's dual eligible is the term, but it's the seniors who are in both Medicare and Medicaid that are very, very expensive for states, and the federal government didn't help us at all with that. Again, a more serious burden is if the cost of this war isn't hurting states, you know. And so I walked by and I heard him speaking, and I knew that if I didn't let him know I was unhappy, I could never complain about him again. How can you be in the same room and be silent? And so I remember when I got up to the mic, I thought it was going to be Edgar Allan Poe and the Telltale Heart all over again. My heart was pounding so tremendously. And I said to him, you know, the reports about Halliburton, I haven't thought about this for a long time, but if I'm remembering right, the reports about Halliburton had just come out, and how they were overcharging. And so I made the point that we were looking for money to help us with Medicare and Medicaid for our senior population. Where we could get the money was for them to stop giving no-bid contracts to a company like Halliburton. I don't know if I said this. It has its headquarters in the Cayman Islands, so it's not even paying taxes in America. You know, I mean, what? And the other thing, and that made me so angry, is that is that Matt had written to me. I remember him saying, Dick Cheney, how did he say that? Dick Cheney must be making money through Halliburton on this place. And they'd been sleeping in the sand with the sand fleas biting them because for weeks Halliburton hadn't gotten the equipment out there that the soldiers needed. When Matt was in Bosnia, it wasn't Halliburton, and the equipment was there.
Yeah, looking at the transcript, you started off by saying that your son is flying helicopters in Baghdad, and Rumsfeld said, tell him thank you, we appreciate the service. And then you said that, I must admit, I wrote a resolution in the Minnesota Senate against going to war unilaterally, and he said, that's why we went in with 32 other countries. And you said, you went on to say, you're very upset about the services to our servicemen that Halliburton is providing. Not only could we save a lot of money if they weren't overcharging us as much as they are, but the services that they are providing now for our servicemen are not as efficient as, for instance, as they were in Bosnia when my son was in Bosnia and the army was responsible for that. So you said, I hope you'll really look into that. And it is a great concern when our servicemen and women are over there and an entity non-bid such as Halliburton is not doing the job that our own army had always done much better. And Rumsfeld responded and said, many places we've moved to private contractors and they've done a very good job. And to the extent they don't do a good job, they get let go as a contractor and it gets changed. And he says, he said, second, I'm not intimately knowledgeable about what you're talking about with respect to this particular company, but I was advised this morning that what's going on, there was no overpayment to any company. And in fact, there is a fairly normal process going on where they submit bills from their subcontractors and from their own. It gets discussed and debated. We've got auditors that crawl all over these things, he said.
I remember that he denied knowledge.
Yes, he ended. He said, and what you're reading about in the paper is not an overpayment at all. It's a disagreement between the United States and the government. He said, I'm not an expert. I shouldn't be speaking about this, but my understanding is it may be a disagreement between the company and the Department of Defense as to what, and possibly between the company and subcontractors, but there has not, to my knowledge, been any overpayment, and I wouldn't want your comment to leave these good folks with a misimpression. And then he said he was going to take another comment.
I remember thinking, he's like a massive tree, and I'm just shoving my fist into the tree and getting nothing but scratches from the bark. I remember thinking, how are we going to move away from this? You know, the whole way that he talks about morality, you know, freedom versus occupation. How do we counter all of these things? I mean, even Kevin Phillips in his book Wealth and Democracy is talking about us living in a plutocracy and you know, government foreign by the wealthy and the poor are unworthy. And what better example than a non-bid contract to Halliburton, you know? How do we even counter this? Because it's not just all of the service people who are dying now. It is why they are dying and what's going to be happening. Who are going to be our leaders?
Minnesota State Senator Becky Lurie lost her son, Matt, in Iraq 2 weeks ago, shot down as pilot of a helicopter. On Friday, 1,200 people attended the memorial for Matt Lurie in Minnesota, including the governor. He'll be buried on Friday at Arlington National Cemetery. This is Democracy Now! You can go to our website, democracynow.org, to sign up for our daily headlines and transcripts of the broadcast. You can watch and see the program there as well. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadoush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, and Maddie Harper. Mike DiFilippo is our engineer. Again, at our website, democracynow.org, you can see any of the segments that you missed, links to all different organizations and the guests that are on our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.